Benjamin Norton Bugby, Sacramento Champagne King. Written and spoken by Kevin Knaus. Chapter 5, Sheriff Bugby, 1861-1864. The Sacramento County Sheriff at this time had the twin responsibilities of law enforcement and tax collections. This dual office function would remain until the end of the 19th century, when Bugby, who ran solely for the office of tax collector in 1898, forced the tax collector duties to be split from the sheriff's office. In the intervening years, it was the tax collector duties that ultimately created the biggest headaches for Bugby. If a property owner failed to pay taxes and property was ordered forfeited by the court order to pay the taxes, it was Bugby who had to seize the property. He also ran into numerous problems collecting taxes targeted specifically at the Chinese immigrant community. Numerous lawsuits were filed against Bugby on the grounds that he illegally seized property or improperly sold it at auction. These lawsuits were not unique to Bugby's tenure as sheriff, nor were the challenges of collecting taxes only applicable to Bugby. All sheriffs before and after Bugby faced the same lawsuits and administrative challenges. Bugby rarely equivocated over whether his actions were within the law. But the lawsuits did force him to spend more time defending his actions in civil court than he would have liked. Bugby's time as sheriff and tax collector was an accelerated course in law enforcement, taxes, the judicial system, and politics. He was introduced to some of the most powerful men in the state as he served on committees for different events. Even though he spent the bulk of his time in Sacramento, he always maintained his home in Folsom. Administration. Salaries and expenses were always chief concerns for the Sacramento County Board of Supervisors. As sheriff, Bugby was paid a salary of $4,000 per year plus mileage. Under Sheriff William Hoag earned $1,880 a year, and deputies B.B. Redding, James Lansing, G.O. Haswell, Ed Christie, and S.W. Griffith were paid $1,500 on an annual basis. For comparison to other county positions, William Shattuck, president of the Board of Supervisors, was paid $3,000 annually, and County Judge C. Clark earned $5,000 per year. Similar to his expense reimbursement requests when he was the constable of Granite Township, Bugby's sheriff expenses were also questioned by the Board of Supervisors. In one instance, Bugby billed the county for $1,100 for travel to Tucson, Arizona, to bring back a prisoner. Under the regulations of 1862, the maximum fixed distances for a reimbursement of 20 cents per mile one way was set at 55 miles to Stockton and 155 miles to San Quentin. Bugby was given the benefit of the doubt that he was fulfilling his legal obligations to travel to Tucson to arrest an individual and bring the prisoner back to Sacramento, but it was not a unanimous decision of the board to pay the expenses. Travel expenses for deputies were also scrutinized by the board. Deputies were employed during trials for summoning jurors and witnesses. Specifically, grand juries were routinely organized for criminal indictments. Instead of always relying on residents and merchants close to the courthouse, Bugby instructed his deputies to travel further out into the county to summon residents to be grand jurors. This made perfect sense to some of the supervisors, to the degree that residents near the courthouse should not be overly burdened with jury duty. The extra expense, it was suggested, was worth having the entire county represented in such court proceedings. As ex officio tax collector, Bugby, like all other sheriffs, was able to keep a portion of the tax to offset his expenses. He was able to retain 10% commission on the collection of most taxes he brought into the county treasury. One of the taxes for which Bugby received a commission was the foreign miners tax. The commissions were intended to be an added inducement for the sheriff to be aggressive with collecting these sorts of taxes. The previous sheriff collected $11,000 per year, while Bugby's foreign miner tax collections totaled closer to $19,000 per year. Part of the increase was due to the fact that Sacramento County had an increase of 25 to 30% in the number of Chinese miners while Bugby was sheriff. James McClatchy, who was elected Sacramento County Sheriff in 1863 after Bugbee lost the nomination, was not impressed with his predecessor's administration or bookkeeping. Bugbee had been awarded the meal contract to prepare and serve food to the county prisoners, but sold the contract to P.F. Murphy. McClatchy did not think the resulting contract was valid and refused Murphy entry to the jail with the meals. McClatchy instead provided his own meals to the prisoners. Sheriff McClatchy also complained that Bugbee had left the business license records in such disarray he had no idea when the former licenses were issued or when they expired. The Board of Supervisors passed a directive to have Bugbee turn over the license book as required by law. After Bugbee was no longer sheriff, but had submitted his last expense reimbursements, some of the county supervisors questioned his honesty and integrity with respect to the commissions due him for tax collections. The board instructed the auditor and district attorney to examine all of Bugbee's fees and expenses as sheriff and tax collector beginning in May 1863. At issue was the bookkeeping of a tax collection commission or fee, and whether it should be withheld before the sheriff deposited the money to the county treasury, or if the sheriff should be reimbursed after an accounting of the receipts. Newly elected Sheriff McClatchy was wrestling with some of the same issues as the county tried to standardize its practices. It probably did not help that Bugbee seemed to be a bit of a sloppy bookkeeper. Regardless, the resolution calling into question Bugbee's honesty by having his tax receipts audited was quickly disputed and found to have no merit. Supervisor Hollister offered a resolution to clear Bugbee of any mischief concerning tax collections while he was sheriff. Whereas, it appearing to this board that ex-Sheriff Bugbee, in his collection of monies for the county, always made prompt and correct payment of such monies into the county treasury at such times as were required by law, with the exception of what he supposed to be his commissions as tax collector. Be it therefore resolved that in certain resolutions passed by the board on the second and fourth days of May, in regard to said ex-Sheriff Bugbee, it was not the intention of this board to censure any of his acts in regard to the collection and payment of monies into the county treasury, as it was held by this board, the question having never been raised in regard to sheriff being entitled to retain fees as tax collector in the manner in which he did, and he is fully exonerated from any intention of wrongdoing in the premises. Be it further resolved that in consideration of the fact that said Bugbee, having been allowed claims against the county in sums much greater than the amount supposed to be due from him to the county, it is the sense of this board that the district attorney be ordered, and by this resolution is hereby ordered, to proceed no further against said Bugbee, but that an agreed case between said district attorney and the attorneys of James McClatchy be had, and the decision and arbitration governing such case shall govern and determine as between the rights of the county and said Bugbee in regard to monies herein before mentioned retained by him as tax collector. Ex officio tax collector. As the county office with the most organized staff that circulated throughout the city and county, it seemed appropriate at the time for the sheriff's department to also collect taxes and licenses. Sacramento County was dependent on the collection of these taxes and fees in order to maintain city and county. The city in particular was having severe growing pains, as they were under a constant threat of flooding during the winter, increased demand for higher quality drinking water in the summer, and problems surrounding sewage disposal. In order to set a firm tone of tax payment compliance, Bugbee sent out his deputies to immediately start collecting license fees. The Sacramento Daily Union noted, "It will be found advisable to pay up when promptly called on." By the end of October 1861, Bugbee had deposited over $25,000 in taxes and licensing fees into the city and county treasuries. In an effort to facilitate payment as ex officio tax collector of state and county taxes, Bugbee would undertake tours of the county to collect tax payments. In 1862, he advertised the 10 different locations and dates he would be available for local residents to come and pay their taxes. His first stop was Harvey's Hotel in American Township on November 4th. Then, from November 5th through the 14th, he announced stops at the 15 Mile House in Center Township, Latham's Store in Mississippi Township, Exchange Hotel in Natoma Township, Patterson Station in Brighton, Kirk Station in Franklin Township, Chamberlain's Store in Georgiana Township, Swain's Schoolhouse in Dry Creek, Fowler's Hotel in Alabama Township, and finally Sherburn's Hotel in Sutter Township. Bugbee would take similar tours of the county for the next 2 years to collect taxes. Sheriff Bugbee didn't waste any time auctioning off property for unpaid taxes either. He held his first public auction of property forfeited for unpaid taxes in November 1861. Sheriff Bugbee was listed on over 200 real estate transactions in the Sacramento County deed books as the seller of property that had been ordered sold by the courts to satisfy a judgment against the owner. Over 50% of these sales were due to delinquent taxes. The Great Flood of 1861-62, which resulted in significant property loss, combined with the subsequent taxes assessed to rebuild and strengthen the levees around Sacramento, also contributed to the necessity for Bugbee to hold numerous sheriff sales to sell property for unpaid taxes. Some Sacramento residents were financially wiped out because of the Great Flood and could not meet their tax burden. Sacramento floods. As Bugbee was setting up his sheriff office and settling into the new job, storm clouds gathered over Northern California, and it began to rain in early December. The rain didn't stop. Sacramento would experience its worst flooding in its young life. The heavy rains would last through March 1862. On December 9, 1861, the little levee on the American River east of 30th Street failed. That led to the failure of a small levee protecting the central city. Sacramento was now a bathtub of floodwater. To drain the water, the city breached the southern levee at 5th and R Streets. The rush of water out of the city, along with the incoming water to the northeast, created strong enough water currents to push homes off of their foundations. Many people lost their lives, and there was significant property damage. On April 9, 1862, Governor Leland Stanford signed the levee law, which created a board of city levee commissioners, along with the power to impose a levee tax on property to fund raising and strengthening the levees around the city. Work on the new levees commenced almost immediately, but revenue from the levee tax was lagging. In July, a contract for $7,311 had been awarded to build the levee from 6th and 8th Street out to 31st Street. Unfortunately, Bugbee had only collected $2,800 in levee tax revenue. Contractors were demanding cash for their progress payments for the work on the levee construction. They had between 1,000 and 1,500 men working on the levee project, many of them earning $40 per month. By late July, with the intention of raising cash for the county, it was announced that Sheriff Bugbee would start filing lawsuits for non-payment of delinquent state and county licenses. This must have been a terrible strain on Sacramento City residents who had been decimated by the floods that had visited the city only 8 months earlier. By August, Bugbee was able to report to the Board of Supervisors that he had collected $10,173 in levy tax the previous week. Undoubtedly, there were a number of residents who lost their property to delinquent levy tax payments if they were unable to sell their properties to someone else. Law enforcement. The Sheriff's Department performed the regular law enforcement duties such as investigating burglaries, murders, assaults, suicides, and drunken brawls. Sheriff Bugbee also had a couple of counterfeiting and fraud cases. By default, Bugbee became a mental health professional as he had to determine the mental capacity of some men and women who were exhibiting confusion and delirium. Some of these folks were escorted by Bugbee to Stockton, where there was a facility for the mentally incapacitated. Bugbee and his deputies also had to escort prisoners to different jurisdictions and men convicted of crimes to the state prison. Even though Bugbee escorted convicted men down to the state prison at San Quentin for long prison terms, it was still the local counties who had to enforce any sentence of death. Bugby inherited the death sentence of Lewis Call. Call was convicted of strangling Catherine Gerken to death at her home at 2nd and L Streets in Sacramento on January 4, 1861. He was found guilty and sentenced to death by Judge J. H. McCune. Call's case was appealed to the state Supreme Court, who let the verdict stand. An appeal for reprieve was even made to the governor, but it was denied. Call, who was only 23 years old, maintained his innocence even as he stood on the gallows flanked by Bugby. He made a lengthy statement proclaiming his innocence, recounting witness testimony and the timeline of events. He thanked his attorneys, Mr. Kaufroth and Mr. Curtis, who had defended him. He also said goodbye to his jailers, Warden Harris, Chief Watson, Deputy Sheriff Lansing, and Lindsay. Then he turned to Sheriff Bugby and said, "I know you are only performing your duty, and I have no hard feelings toward you for it." Lewis Call fell through the trap door of the gallows erected on the second floor of the county jail at 7 minutes past one on November 29, 1861. He was pronounced dead 10 minutes later. At the end of Bugby's term as sheriff in 1863, he again found himself in the role of executioner. This time it was George N. Simons, who had been convicted of murdering B. F. Russell on the night of July 11, 1860, near Benson's Ferry. District Court Judge McCune sentenced him to death for the murder. While generally calm in demeanor, Simons expressed bitterness over his wife living with J. W. Knaggs, who happened to be one of the officers who arrested him for the murder. On December 4th, the evening before the execution, Sheriff Bugby visited Simons in his cell. Simons had always maintained his innocence and blamed his situation on the influence of bad company he kept. That evening, Bugby asked Simons if he still denied his guilt. Bugby wanted Simons to confess in order to remove any later doubt that he might have executed an innocent man. Simons is reported to have told Bugby that he should have no guilt about putting an innocent man to death. He was only doing his job. The next day, while standing on the trap door of the gallows constructed on the second floor of the jailhouse, Simons stated that if there were any published confessions of guilt attributed to him, they were entirely fictitious. Bugby then adjusted the rope around Simons' neck, and after a few prayers and a hymn, he touched the lever that opened the trap door, allowing Simons to be hanged. The Chinese Assault. In the rough-and-tumble frontier town of Sacramento, where the liquor flowed freely and gambling was ubiquitous, a little use of excessive force by a law enforcement officer was seen as a virtue for curtailing crime. But the Sacramento community did have its limits for acceptable force when arresting or interrogating individuals. Sheriff Bugby crossed this line into the realm of excessive force on at least one occasion. As the tax and license collector for Sacramento County, Sheriff Bugby was also in charge of collecting the foreign miners' tax of 1852 from Chinese miners. In April of 1862, the California legislature passed another tax on Chinese immigrants titled "An Act to Protect Free White Labor Against Competition with Chinese Coolie Labor and Discourage the Immigration of the Chinese into the State of California." It levied a $2.50 police tax on each Chinese person, male and female, over the age of 18 years of age. As with most tax collections, the sheriff got to keep a percentage of the tax collection. In this case, it was 20%. In Sacramento City, a large bulk of the Chinese immigrants lived along I Street, which was also the southern border of China Slough. This body of water was fed by the Sacramento River to the west and was originally named Sutter's Lake. When Chinese immigrants started building little shanties on stilts on the shoreline of the water body, it became known as China Slough. In early June of 1862, Sheriff Bugby and one of his deputies went to the Chinese community along I Street to collect the new police tax. This may have been the first or second time Bugby and his deputies went to collect the police tax, since it had only become law less than 2 months earlier. In addition to language challenges, many Chinese may never have heard of this new tax that they were expected to pay on a monthly basis. Chinese immigrant Chu Yu resisted paying the police tax to Sheriff Bugby and Deputy S.S. Ingham. The pair escorted Yu back to the police station where Officer Stewart locked Yu up. Shortly after, Yu was taken into the sheriff's office. Several people on the street and in adjoining buildings heard loud, terrifying screams of pain emanating from the office. The offices of the Sacramento Daily Union were right next door to the police station, and the newspaper reported the incident. A gross outrage. At dusk last evening, a Chinaman was taken into the sheriff's office, and if screams and strokes can be taken as an index, was beaten in an unmerciful manner for some 10 or 15 minutes. His cries attracted the attention of the neighbors a block off. When the windows of the office were closed, a number of citizens went to the door of the office but found them locked. They knocked, but there was no response. In a few minutes, the strokes and screams were resumed. The victim seemed, from the sound, to have been gagged. He afterwards jumped through the window and, striking on the roof of an outbuilding, fell to the ground. He was taken into the sheriff's office. Sheriff Bugby was in the room at the time. Whether any others except the Chinaman were there or not, we are not advised. A large number of citizens collected around the building, and on insisting upon admission, the doors were unlocked. The Chinaman appeared to be seriously injured. Bugby said in response to injuries that the man was under arrest for assault and battery. The Sacramento Daily Union continued to editorialize about the incident. The transaction was a gross outrage, and such as should not be tolerated in any civilized community. The sheriff and his deputies are clothed by law with all the authority which the community deems it wise to entrust them with. When they arrest under legal process a miserable Chinaman and lock themselves up out of sight to inflict torture which they would not dare administer in the presence of white witnesses, they are guilty of a cowardly and diabolical crime. If there is no law to meet such a case, the criminal code is sadly in need of amendment. After the above was written, we were called upon by Deputy Sheriff, who was not present at the time of the occurrence of the affair, and one who was, together with a Chinaman who speaks English. The deputy who was present stated that the Chinaman was not whipped and that all the noise resulted from an attempt to handcuff him. The Chinaman stated that he had seen and conversed with the Chinaman in the sheriff's office since the affair above narrated had taken place, and that he stated that he had not been whipped. If this version of the case is correct, some 50 citizens besides ourselves were grossly deceived by the sounds which emanated from the room. Deputy Ingham was charged with assault and tried later in the month. Mr. P. Coggins, while working in the offices of the Sacramento Daily Union, testified that he heard screams of a man in distress. He tried to enter the sheriff's office, but the doors were locked. He said the torture sounded like a cane striking a man, with muffled sounds of a gagged man. Sheriff Bugby appeared at the window, and Coggins asked why he would permit such an assault. Bugby replied, "If you say I have whipped a Chinaman, you are a blank liar." His reply only referred to himself and not Deputy Ingham. Henry Starr, who was a prominent auctioneer with an office in Sacramento, testified that Deputy Sheriff Lansing arrived and unlocked the sheriff's office door. Bugby came rushing forward in shirt sleeves and panting to prevent any of the gathered crowd from entering the office. A doctor examined you the next day and confirmed that many of the injuries seemed to have occurred from a beating and possibly falling off a window onto the street. Deputy Sheriff Lansing testified that he saw you sitting quietly in front of the stove when he entered the office, and he did not seem hurt. Then you got up, ran over to the window, and jumped out of it. Lansing then went outside, brought you back into the sheriff's office. Deputy B.B. Redding testified that Bugby had arrested you for assaulting a Chinese man. Deputy Ingham's defense was that he did not whip you, but had only hit him once or twice while you was resisting Ingham, putting him in leg irons and handcuffs. In addition, most of you's injuries resulted from him jumping out of the office window and landing on the street below. Deputy Sheriff Ingham was found guilty of assault and battery on you in the sheriff's office. He was fined $40. From the testimony of the officers, compared to the men who heard Yu's screams in agony, it's most probable that the deputies conspired to spin a tale that mitigated any excessive force or torture on the part of Deputy Ingham and Bugby's involvement. Bugby received no punishment for his culpability in the assault on Chu Yu, other than possibly a blemish on his reputation. The sheriff's office was able to collect $1,488 for the police tax and $1,486 for the foreign miner's license from Chinese immigrants in June of 1862. The police tax was found to be unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court in September 1862. Sheriff sales. If Sacramento County or city residents were not able to pay their tax bills or had judgments against them for unpaid debts, it was the sheriff's duty to sell their properties on the steps of the courthouse to the highest bidder. Since Bugby had lost his farm out by Salisbury Station to a sheriff's sale, he was familiar with the procedures. If the property was not a lot or structure, there were times when Bugby had to auction off property on site. In one instance, he had to supervise the auction of plant material. He advertised a sheriff's sale for the collection of choice and valuable plants and shrubs consisting of camellias, orange trees, roses, geraniums, lilies, verbenas, heliotropes, fuchsias, and cacti from Smith's Garden. The demise of Smith's Garden was the result of an unpaid loan for the business and property rent. Even though Bugby was just following court orders, he was named as a defendant in a lawsuit to stop the sale of plant material. Nonetheless, the sale went forward, much to the delight of buyers of the trees and plants. The Sacramento Daily Union reported the sheriff's sale was a success. Titled Cheap Shade Trees for Sale, the newspaper noted that the sale at 6th and K Street of elm, linden, and locust trees had been brisk. The union editorialized, "The readiness of our citizens to buy and plant shade trees indicates commendable determination to improve and beautify their homesteads." Bugby helped accelerate the elm tree canopy for which Sacramento would become known, and he gained insight into the sale of agricultural products, knowledge he would use in the future. The state Supreme Court weighed in on the matter of Bugby's sheriff sale trees in its decision on Robison v. Russell, in which the mortgager of the Smith Garden property claimed the plants could be used to satisfy the delinquent mortgage. The court found that Bugby did not overstep his authority because he oversaw the removal of plant material from Smith's Gardens to satisfy the judgment. The removal of the plant material did not diminish the value of the land on which a mortgage had been secured, the court ruled. Social affairs. Bugby loved plants and growing them. He grew a variety of different raisins and wine grapes along with orange and fig trees at his Natoma vineyard. He reveled in his farm produce from land he cultivated in Sutter County and displayed at the state fair. After he made Sacramento City his permanent home in the 1880s, he planted a variety of trees, shrubs, and flowers. He donated all of his yucca flowers from his Sacramento property to the grand wedding event between Celia Simmons and Dwight Miller, who was the eldest son of Frank Miller of the banking firm D.O. Mills. The wedding and Bugby's flower donation made the social news, noting that Mr. and Mrs. B.N. Bugby fairly stripped their garden of its lovely yucca flowers for the occasion. When Bugby closed up his Sacramento furniture shop and moved out to Salisbury Station to farm, he left Sacramento behind. As the constable of Granite Township, he traveled to Sacramento mainly for law enforcement business. Because Bugby lived in Folsom, he may have been one of the first commuters between that city and Sacramento on the Sacramento Valley Railroad. Now he was the sheriff of Sacramento County, and either by choice or recruitment, he became more involved in civic affairs and entertainment. One of his first introductions into the political power structure of Sacramento and the state of California happened when he served on the inaugural ball committee for Governor Leland Stanford. The executive committee for the January 8, 1862 event included Charles Crocker, D.O. Mills, and J.P. Robinson. Bugby served on the general committee along with B.F. Hastings, Mark Hopkins, James McClatchy, Judge McCune, and many other business and elected people of the state. He would also work with local Sacramento dignitaries as part of the honorary committee for the annual ball to raise money for Sacramento's Fire Engine Company No. 1. Other committee members included B.F. Hastings, Leland Stanford, James McClatchy, and Judge McCune. As the nation was gripped by civil war, Bugbee started a collection for the United States Sanitary Commission to support sick and wounded soldiers of the Union Army. This was a cause near to Bugbee's heart, as his own brother George had been severely wounded in the war. In November of 1862, the sheriff's office donated $500 to the sanitary fund. Bugbee contributed $187, while all the deputies gave lesser amounts. Bugbee was one of thousands of men who traveled to Sacramento in 1849. He and other men grew so fond of the region and opportunities, they decided to call it home for the rest of their lives. One of the men who made the trek from the East Coast to Sacramento was W.W. Kurtz. Kurtz, along with Bugbee, James McClatchy, Israel Luce, and others, sailed from New York to Mexico, where they traveled overland to Mazatlan, then took a boat to San Francisco, arriving in June 1849. Kurtz found employment at the Sacramento Daily Union and became the foreman of the composing room. He worked there until he was taken ill at the end of 1862. He died in San Francisco, where he retired to regain his health in late 1863. Perhaps because of Kurtz's passing, Bugbee decided to formally join the Sacramento Pioneer Association. Organized in 1854, the association's goal was to preserve the stories and history of the men who came to California before January 1, 1850. This also provided Bugbee another opportunity to network with men who were 49ers but also held prominent positions in government and business, such as Governors Bigler, Johnson, and Booth, and including men from the finance world such as B.F. Hastings and D.O. Mills. The editors of the major Sacramento daily newspapers, J. Anthony of the Union and McClatchy the Bee, were also members of the Pioneer Association. Bugbee was also a patron and supporter of the arts in Sacramento. He and many other men were overcome with gratitude for the extended appearance of actress Annette Ince in several plays performed at the Metropolitan Theater. Ince, who lived and acted mainly in the Bay Area, spent much of October 1863 in Sacramento performing in dramas and comedies that month. Over 50 men, including Bugbee, signed their names to a letter thanking the actress for her time and performances in Sacramento and offered her a complimentary benefit on the date of her choosing. To Miss Annette Ince, Madam, hearing you are about closing your engagement in this city, we, the undersigned, having enjoyed the intellectual treat you have afforded us in your classic representations, wish to express our admiration of your worth as a lady and talent as an actress, in a substantial manner, and beg to offer you complimentary benefit to take place on any night acceptable to yourself. In what would be a rare family reunion, George Bugbee, Bugbee's younger brother, visited him in Sacramento. George was one of the first men from Connecticut to be injured in the Civil War. The injury to George's shoulder left him permanently disabled, even though he retained the arm. By contrast, Bugbee's worst injury occurred when he was wrestling Dr. Bates in Folsom, presumably in a friendly match of machismo. Bugbee landed wrong and dislocated his ankle. He recuperated at his residence in Folsom until he could return to work full-time. Lawsuits. Bugbee had no training in the law, and he had no training in law enforcement beyond his years as constable of Granite Township. California had only been a state for about 11 years when he became Sacramento County Sheriff. This meant that many of the new local and state civil laws were in a state of flux as individuals appealed adverse court decisions. There were times when Bugbee felt his actions were completely within the law, only to have a court decide otherwise. Not only were recently passed laws called into question, the actual county boundaries had not been properly surveyed. This became an issue in 1861 when Bugbee was on the South Fork of the American River above Mormon Island collecting the foreign miners' tax on Chinese immigrants. The miners protested paying the tax because they felt they were in El Dorado County, and Bugbee had no jurisdiction. Bugbee confiscated tools and mining equipment in lieu of the miners' tax because he was certain the Chinese immigrants were mining in Sacramento County. The Chinese miners sued for $10,000 in damages. After careful consideration, Bugbee decided to settle out of court for substantially reduced damages. He must have realized that there was a high probability that the miners were in El Dorado County. the lawsuit was dismissed, which left the question of the exact boundary between Sacramento and El Dorado County in doubt even as late as 1864. This area along the South Fork of the American River was not unknown to Bugbee. He had mined in the region in 1849 and would go on to purchase property a couple years later that was slightly east of Sacramento County in the county of El Dorado. As sheriff, Bugbee was sued no less than 15 times over his actions concerning property he either seized or sold. He was also sued several times for his actions as constable of Granite Township. In some of the court cases, Bugbee prevailed. In others, he was ordered to pay damages. And a few cases were overturned in an appellate court. Several of the cases were appealed all the way to the state Supreme Court. A couple of those cases were decided in Bugbee's favor and set judicial precedent for the 19th century in California. Woodliffe v. Bugbee. In 1856, Mary Woodliffe sued Bugbee over a property dispute. Mary Woodliffe, who was only 16 years old at the time, took a gold watch and a chair to a repairman in Folsom. Bugbee, as constable of Granite Township, confiscated the property. Mary sued for the value of the property. Bugbee declared he could show that Mary did not own the property in question and that it had been stolen. A.P. Catlin and C.G.W. French represented Ms. Woodliffe at a small trial conducted with six jurors before the Granite Township Justice of the Peace. The jury found in favor of the defendant, B.N. Bugbee. White v. Bugbee. Bugbee was ordered to seize the property of A.H. White to settle a judgment against him in 1858. White contended the property seized was exempt from the judgment. The complaint by White requested to recover $98 from Bugbee with $80 as damages. Bugbee sold the property, a clock and a half a ton of hay, at auction to satisfy the judgment against White. Bugbee was represented by F.S. Mumford of Mormon Island. Hopper and Ewing attorneys represented Mr. White. The case was dismissed. Woods v. Bugbee. In the spring of 1860, a local Sacramento company owned by Mr. O'Neill had built a large kiln to fire clay bricks. The kiln was 130 feet long, 30 feet wide, and 15 feet high. In October 1861, O'Neill was in debt to Mr. Woods. O'Neill had his kiln filled with green unfired clay bricks. In order to satisfy his debt, O'Neill sold the kiln full of green bricks to Woods and further agreed to proceed with the firing at his own expense, so Woods would have a finished product to sell. Woods bought a kiln of green bricks but would get finished fired bricks that he could sell at a higher price. O'Neill fired up the kiln on November 11th and the bricks were completely fired by November 19th. Bricks were in high demand to build fireproof buildings. As Sacramento had seen a number of fires destroy large swaths of residential and commercial districts over the years, owners wanted to rebuild with bricks if possible. There were only two firms in April 1860 who were manufacturing bricks in Sacramento. The first was Callahan, Fox, and Tansman, and the other was O'Neill. O'Neill also owed money to a Mr. Harris, who had threatened and won a lawsuit for the recovery of the debt. Before the firing of the bricks was complete, Sheriff Bugbee attached the bricks as payment for the judgment against O'Neill to Harris. Woods did not get the kiln full of bricks to sell that he bought from O'Neill. Woods sued Sheriff Bugbee over his actions and won based on the statutes of frauds. Bugbee appealed for a new trial, and that motion was denied. He then appealed to the state Supreme Court. Attorney H.H. Hartley represented Bugbee and attorney George Cadwallader, the respondent. Both of these attorneys would alternately represent Bugbee in court and also represent plaintiffs against him in future court battles. The opinion of the court, as handed down in 1866 by Justice J. Curry, focused on the possession of the property. Even though Woods bought the kiln of clay bricks from O'Neill, he never actually took possession of them. O'Neill remained in possession of the kiln and paid for the wood and employees to complete the firing of the bricks. The judgment in favor of Harris and subsequent attachment by Bugbee occurred while O'Neill was in the possession of the kiln and firing of the bricks. Justice Curry wrote, "There was nothing done by the plaintiff, Woods, to indicate to anyone that he had any property in the kiln of bricks. Notwithstanding, he visited the premises 5 times while the bricks were in the process of burning. The fact that O'Neill finished the work of burning the kiln the day before it was attached and informed the plaintiff the next day before the sheriff levied that he had completed the work and told to take his property does not, in our judgment, aid the plaintiff. O'Neill had been all the while, from the time of his contract with plaintiff, in actual and open possession of the property, added by his labor, care, and skill to its value, and this, too, by an arrangement made by him with the plaintiff. After he had done his work, he gave the plaintiff notice that he had completed his part of the contract and told him to take the property. This was the first time it was ever proposed to make a complete and final delivery of the property, which, if effectuated, would have amounted to an open and visible change of possession. The judgment denying a new trial by the lower court was reversed, awarding Bugby, and judgment for the defendant was entered." Peter E. v. Bugby and Beck. Another case that reached the state Supreme Court involved the question of witness testimony. A Mr. Stackhouse owed money to Robert Beck. Mr. Beck secured a judgment against Stackhouse for the repayment of the money. Sheriff Bugby executed the court decision by confiscating the property that Stackhouse had bought on credit from Beck. But before the seizure occurred, Mr. G.C. Petery claimed to have bought the property in question from Stackhouse. Beck had a partner in his operation by the name of Mr. W. Ackley. Ackley sold his interest to Beck in the operation when he saw Stackhouse's debt had become very large and before Bugby seized the property from Stackhouse to satisfy the judgment against him. At the sheriff's sale, Beck bought the property back and sold part of the property to Ackley. Ackley testified at the trial of Petery v. Bugby. Petery lost in the first court case but appealed on the grounds that Ackley could not testify in the case because he had bought from Beck a portion of the property sued for and assigned his portion of the business over to Beck. Petery won on appeal and was awarded $1,400 plus $100 in damages. Bugby, not wanting to pay Petery for an action he believed to be permissible under his authority as sheriff, appealed the ruling to the state Supreme Court. At issue was whether Ackley, who was a witness for the defense, had a vested interest in the outcome of the lawsuit brought by Petery. The Supreme Court ruled that they could not disturb the judgment rendered by the original jury trial. Even though there was conflicting testimony in the trial by the witness, it was the duty of the jury to weigh the evidence presented and render a verdict. Justice C.J. Sanderson wrote, "Where the testimony is conflicting, the result mainly depends on the credibility of the witness. Of that the jury and the court below have an opportunity to judge, but this court has not. Should we attempt to weigh the evidence as it is presented to us and decide between conflicting statements, the chances for the intervention of error would be increased rather than diminished." Both the Woods and the Petery State Supreme Court decisions set precedent and would go on to be cited in other court cases for decades. Bugby did not cry over his court defeats or crow over his victories. He probably never thought he would spend so much time in a courtroom defending himself when he immigrated to California to become a gold miner. His involvement in the judicial system eliminated any intimidation he may have had about fighting for what he thought was right. He never became an overly litigious individual, but he refused to back down when he thought he was standing on the right side of the law. 1863, McClatchy v. Bugby. With the opening of the Union County Democrat Party nominating convention in June 1863, the country was still in a civil war, and loyalty to the Union was a political wedge issue. Delegates from the 3rd and 4th wards had chosen to leave the convention for muddled reasons. They were urged to return to the convention because it was their duty as loyal Union men to stand by the current Republican president during the time of civil war. The delegates who left the convention countered that they left because they felt that the defeat of their candidates they endorsed was a foregone conclusion. It was during this political drama that nominations for Sacramento County Sheriff were called. Candidates James McClatchy, John Rooney, and Wyman McMitchell, along with Bugbee, were put into nomination. Bugbee stated he was an unconditional Union man. His family had fought in the War of Independence, and it was widely known that his brother was gravely wounded fighting for the Union. He strongly protested that he had any secessionist leanings, as some people were accusing him of having. After Bugbee's remarks to the convention, the secretary was asked to read a document outlining the creation of the Democrat Party-leaning newspaper in California by ex-Governor Bigler. Bugbee was then questioned about his role in helping fund a newspaper called The Republican. Bugbee answered that he met Governor Bigler on the street about a year earlier and was asked by the governor if he would pay a $25 subscription to get the newspaper started. Many of Bugbee's acquaintances were involved with the newspaper's creation, including James Lansing and Edward Christie. Bugbee told Governor Bigler that as long as the Republican was a good Union paper, he would have no problem supporting it. After seeing the first printing, Bugbee said he thought it a secessionist newspaper and threw it away. However, the paper continued to be delivered to the sheriff's office, and he had no way of preventing his deputies from reading it. There were also accusations of Bugbee employing copperhead deputies. A copperhead was a term for Democrats who opposed the Civil War and wanted an immediate peace settlement. Republicans likened people who wanted a peace treaty with the South to a venomous copperhead snake as a way of vilifying their position. Whether this was Bugbee's position or not, he never stated. But associating with or employing copperheads was a sign of disloyalty to the Union in the eyes of the Union and Republican parties. There was no civil service system in the sheriff's office in the 1860s. Elected sheriffs got to select their undersheriff and deputies, who were usually their friends, neighbors, and fellow political party members. There was an implied association and loyalty to the man who hired you. This loyalty was on full display when the deputies corroborated Bugbee and Ingman's claim that they never tortured or abused Chinese immigrant Yu. Most voters understood that whoever they elected would be hiring subordinates of their same political persuasion and ideology. After two convention ballots, Rooney and McMitchell withdrew their names from consideration, and the race was between Bugbee and McClatchy. On the fourth ballot, McClatchy was nominated as the candidate for sheriff's office. Bugbee was still very popular in the eastern portion of Sacramento County, being seen as a countryman and not a Sacramento City insider. Some of the residents of Folsom circulated a petition expressing dissatisfaction with the nomination of McClatchy and pledging support to Bugbee. There was also a movement to draft Bugbee as a candidate at the Democrat County Convention to be held later in June. Bugbee, however, was a loyal party man. He placed an ad in the Sacramento Union declining the offer to be a candidate for the office of sheriff. Editor, Sacramento Union, dear sir, in your issue of today, I notice, with pride, the names of many warm friends, citizens of this county, tendering me their support in the coming election for the office of sheriff. I am indebted to the most of them, in a great measure, for the position I now occupy, and I take this opportunity of expressing to them my sincere thanks for past favors. At this time, it becomes my duty to inform them that, although it would have given me a great deal of pleasure to have been their candidate for that office, yet I must decline that honor, having been before the Union Convention when another was selected for that position. I am therefore not a candidate, either independent or otherwise. Respectfully yours, B. N. Bugbee. James McClatchy would step down from his position as editor of the Sacramento Bee, run for sheriff, and win. McClatchy would encounter many of the same bureaucratic and legal challenges that Bugbee did when he was sheriff. It was apparent that Bugbee's support within the city of Sacramento was thin. Most of his support came from outlying townships. Also undercutting his support was a campaign most likely, with the knowledge of McClatchy, to paint Bugbee as a Confederate sympathizer. However, Bugbee was pragmatic about the situation. The fact that he and McClatchy had traveled to California together did not imply any long-term loyalty or friendship. This was politics, and politics was dirty. Possibly taking away from the sting of losing his job as sheriff and role as official public persona was the fact that Bugbee had started acquiring land along the South Fork of the American River in 1863. While law enforcement was now in his blood, along with tax collections, farming and the desire to be a farmer remained an important part of Bugbee's life. Since he was a man of high energy, shedding the constant demands on his time of his sheriff and tax collector responsibilities meant he could devote more time to his agricultural pursuits. Bugbee received on-the-job training and a concentrated education in the law through his time as a constable and sheriff. He would lean on these experiences and lessons as he faced other challenges in his life. When life's fortune turned against him, Bugbee would return to the field of law enforcement. He would also run for sheriff several more times, none with success.